recorded in Indianapolis, Indiana. Welcome to the Infamous Indie Podcast. I'm your host, Joe Melillo. This show features real-life stories of Indiana's most infamous horrors, Circle City serial killers, and crimes, both current and cold. I sit down and interview people who know these crimes the best. Sometimes they're authors, sometimes law enforcement, and even family members of the victims. In the end, you'll see a darker side of Hoosier hospitality.
Oh yes, Hoosier hospitality definitely takes a different meaning for this episode. Welcome back, everybody. I'm super excited to bring you this episode because we talked to the great-great-grandson of H.H. Holmes, the devil in the White City, America's first serial killer, and who some believe could be possibly Jack the Ripper. Yes, I said it. It's crazy. And I go over that in this episode with my friend Al Hunter, and sitting beside him along with me is Jeffrey Mudgett, the great-great-grandson of H.H. Holmes, who has taken it upon himself to try to prove that theory. He's even dug up the grave of his grandfather to try to prove that he actually escaped police custody before he was hung. Now, that theory isn't held widely by a lot of people, but Jeff is trying to prove it, and he's working with the authorities and the FBI and people like the FBI to try to figure this out so that he can prove this. You can go read his book, Bloodstains. As he describes it, it's more like a novel based on history and based on true facts. So it all started for Jeffrey Mudgett when he was younger. He was a lawyer in California, and then all of a sudden, his grandfather pulled him and his family into a room and told them that their great-great-grandfather, his grandfather, was actually H.H. Holmes. And it was at that moment that Jeff Mudgett's life changed forever. So he has now dedicated his life to trying to prove some of the main things about his great-great-grandfather, because he, like many others, are just trying to understand what was going through this person's mind. Just like we try to do here, we try to understand what exactly goes through someone's mind when they turn so evil. You'll have to hear, stay tuned, you're gonna love this one. He'll explain it. I apologize for my nasaliness this episode, guys. I've been sick, so you know, we're all human, and I got to get this podcast out, so I wanted to bring this to you. You guys are going to love it. You're going to love it. You're going to love it. I'm super excited. Thank you again. Stay tuned for after the episode for updates for more on Infamous Indie Podcast. All right. Enjoy the show. Welcome, everybody, to the Infamous Indie Podcast. I'm your host, Joe Melillo. In an unbelievably special episode, we have the descendant of serial killer H.H. Holmes. Sitting, I can touch you. That's how close you are. You're real. And his name is Jeff Mudgett.
Yeah, and that might be a little bit too close. Too close. Well, yeah.
Hey, listen,
I've got tendencies, idiosyncrasies that came up from way back.
So thank you very much for doing this. Let's tell everybody why you're in Indianapolis. And Al Hunter's here, everyone. Before we get started, I can't forget about my friend Al. You heard him on the last podcast talk about DC Stevenson, and specifically Madge Oberholzer, and about her life and what happened to her. So, Al, welcome back.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
So we're all kind of in a triangle here on this microphone. And Jeff, why tell everybody what you are here for in Indianapolis.
You know, the team from Ghost Adventures called me last week and asked if I'd come be a part of their episode regarding the Howard Peitzel murder, the young boy that Holmes killed. Maybe the most infamous crime scene in American history, which still exists in all its entirety. So all of these networks want to touch it, and they want to put it on film. So they gave me a call and said, hey, would you come out? I'm here. I did it. I was a little bit reticent because these guys are ghost finders, and I'm hoping to make sure, being there, I can make sure they're serious about what happened there, the crime that was committed, the horror that the little boy suffered through, and how we need to remember something like that rather than some comedic ghost, you know, scene.
This is something that is very important for my podcast. It is number one when I listen to true crime podcasts, I get a little frustrated at just the facts, and we're kind of exploiting these terrible things that happen to these normal people, like everyday life, right? My job here is to try to change the
culture,
yeah, of true crime podcasts. And that what you just said there makes my heart jump, because that's what I want to do here. So it's great that you're doing it. I'm not a paranormal guy. I'm not a paranormal podcast. We are here to talk about facts, but more importantly, what can we learn from these terrible things that happened from two normal people, like everyday life. So that's great that you're here for that. What I guess my first question is, when it comes to the H.H. Holmes legacy, and also how much do you deal with that? Because it affects you through time. I mean, you are literally the example of his legacy affecting a family generations later.
You know, I'm glad you asked me that, because I get hung up on that quite a bit. I get my mother asking me, why did you set aside your career in law to go do this thing about this horrible man that's in your background? Why didn't you just forget about it and move on? Well, I can tell you this. At any one time in America, there's 60, 70, 80 million people that are fascinated with the evil that men do, with serial killers, okay? With premeditated murder and the motives why someone would do these things. Just turn on the TV and you can see it on the guide every night. Mm-hmm. I'm one of those people, okay? It fascinates me, and I'm not afraid to admit it. I'm not ashamed to admit it. I just happen to have a platform based on who my origins. Let's face it, the reason I'm here with you both today are the conscious decisions of maybe the most evil man in American history. Okay? So, and that gives me a platform, that gives me the chance to talk about what we need to do to see if we can stop this from ever happening again. And I don't want it to be a comedy. I don't want it to be a play. I don't want it to be an opera like we have now in New York, an opera about H.H. Holmes. There's series coming out. Paramount's making a series for Netflix. We got Hollywood movies coming out about Holmes. There's a tidal wave of information coming. I'd rather be here with you to discuss the forensics, the new forensics, the developments that I've got happening now that I'm going to, I hope, take the world by storm. I've got the FBI helping me on him being Jack the Ripper all of a sudden. I've got some exciting developments that, I got to tell you, I don't quite know how to handle them. They're coming so fast.
The history themselves, you know, the Jack the Ripper, if you didn't know, anybody who's listening, American Ripper is the name of the television series. It was an 8-part series.
Miniseries.
Miniseries on the History Channel. History, actually. It's technically history. But they're
very sensitive about that.
That's right. That's right. They used to be the History Channel, but now it's just history. But you can watch that, and that is a very interesting, interesting story. More importantly, for my listeners in Indiana, there's an Irvington connection, and Al knows that very well. Al, why don't you explain a little bit about that Irvington connection and what we know about H.H. Holmes in Indiana?
Well, we've talked about this crime in Irvington for, this will be our 18th year. And when we first started this, nobody knew it was Irvington. They referred to it as Indianapolis, where this crime took place. It was Irvington's first murder. It was in an area. What makes this area interesting and attractive to Holmes was Irvington at the time was home to Butler College. And he picked this cottage specifically because it was as far out as the streetcar went from Indianapolis at the time. So that was literally the end of the line. It was secluded. He rented it using a false name with the intention of getting rid of that boy. If you go back and read his testimony, which he did record, there's a certain amount of guilt that he had for killing this little boy. Now, whether that was crocodile tears or not, we don't know. But he did express a little bit of guilt. He set out to poison him, and he ended up strangling him. And what makes this interesting to numerologists, you're talking about a 10-year-old boy that was killed at 10 p.m. on the 10th day of the 10th month, and his body was found by two other 10-year-old boys. So it's eerie. There's an awful lot of eeriness around this crime. And when you go visit this plot of area, and it really doesn't matter where you stand, which house, because there are two houses involved, it doesn't matter because it is a crime scene. His body was never completely recovered, and the majority of it is still there in Irvington in the ground.
Even using cadaver dogs to, ancient cadaver dogs to look up where that spot could possibly be. Al, just real quick, tell everybody who that little boy was and why is he important?
Well, 10-year-old Howard Peitzel was the son of Benjamin and Carrie Peitzel. They worked for Holmes in Chicago. They were extremely good at making children, and Holmes took advantage of that. He took these kids and conned them into letting him put insurance policies on each of these kids' head and then turn them in with false other children to collect these insurance policies. He assured the family that he would keep these children safe, and they believed him. Mm-hmm. When he came into Indianapolis, he was traveling with 10-year-old Howard, Howard's two sisters, and his wife, Georgiana Yoke, who was from Franklin, Indiana. People forget about her. He took them in three different places. Georgiana, his wife, and the two little girls were staying in separate hotels on Monument Circle. They literally, if they wanted to, if one of them would have shouted, the other one would have heard it, and they had no idea that they were there. He took Howard out to Irvington with the expressed reason. He was looking for a reason to get rid of this boy. He finally did. Howard was, again, Irvington's first murder victim. Howard is still there, literally still there. And figuratively still there. I mean, that's why we're here tonight, is there are many, many people. I talk about it on my ghost tours. There are many, many people that believe he's still there. And if ever there was a reason for that to be going on, it would be here because, as Jeff said earlier, this was a gruesome, gruesome crime.
My understanding is that that discovery of his body was the reason that H.H. Holmes was connected to the murder castle, because police were able to then track him and then eventually get to him.
Well, his body was discovered. We owe his capture to a detective with the Pinkertons by the name of Frank Geyer. If Frank Geyer had not chased H.H. Holmes, he would have gotten away. And Holmes knew, it's kind of like if you've ever seen Butch and Sundance, when they get to the point where they know they're being followed by that posse they can't shake, that was Holmes. Holmes knew, he reached a point where he knew, I can't get away from this guy, because Geyer was going to get him. So he went out to Philly, and he said, yeah, I'm a fraudster. I'll cop to that fraudster, throw me in jail, basically to get away from Geyer. Mm-hmm. So technically, while Holmes was jailed for one offense, they quickly connected him to another. And it's still the only crime he was ever convicted of was killing the Peitzel father, right?
Yeah, that was Benjamin. The only murder he was tried for and found guilty.
Yeah.
Right. And your question about why he was connected with the murder castle, the Chicago police were watching what was going on out here in the Indianapolis papers. Yep. And they started putting 2 + 2 together. If this man could be this horrible out here with this little boy, let's go take a look at the property he owns in Englewood, Chicago. And when they went out to the murder castle, they made the discovery.
That's unbelievable. It gives me chills to think that Indianapolis is so connected to it. And it was such a short time he was here in general, you know, in the overall span of things. Let's go on a little bit, Jeff, to less the history, but more of where we're at now and what we know and what maybe some of the new stuff that you're finding out that you can divulge.
Sure. Just recently, the FBI came out with an article which, as you can imagine, took me by surprise, and I was quite pleased. They wrote an article about forensic handwriting analysis using a computer software program that goes beyond two experts arguing in court about what is or isn't the same handwriting. And lo and behold, the computer software program the FBI is telling the world they now use is the same one, the same doctor that I used to compare the Dear Boss letter with the Holmes correspondence before I did my TED Talk in Vancouver. We now have the FBI saying, oh, That's the one to use, the same one I used. So now I'm in a position, Joe, of saying, okay, world, go take the Dear Boss letter, go take the Holmes correspondence, go call Dr. Srihari, take the FBI along with you and run it again on the program. Mm. And you're going to see the handwriting is the same.
The letter, the dear, that what you're talking about is actually how Jack the Ripper, we're connecting H.H. Holmes to being Jack the Ripper. I think it's an incredible story, and when I tell people that don't know about this, I get a lot of excitement out of them because they've never heard this before. But you know, there has been DNA recently that has said that he was actually a barber, an immigrant barber who was living in London. What does that have to do with? What's your opinion on that?
There, Joe, I try to stay away from talking down other theories about who is and who isn't Jack the Ripper, and I saw what you're talking about. I read as many articles as I could pull up off Google about it. I do know that the DNA that they were referencing, we had looked at before, and it was questionable whether the shawl was even Catherine Eddowes. That was the murder we were talking about, whether the DNA connected a shawl to Catherine Eddowes, which is the one which ties Holmes to the Dear Boss letter. Mm. So I had my doubts already because I think in my mind, I've solved who murdered Catherine Eddowes, not the other ones. And that's the problem a lot of Ripperologists have. I don't have any connection of Holmes to the other ones. And I'll give you an interesting sidebar about that. When we were in London, Scotland Yard came up to me and told me that they had long thought there were two copycats. They didn't think one man had killed all five anyway. Mm. So, you know, that ran right down my theory. But the DNA you're talking about, I've tried to stay away from talking that down because obviously if that works out, that's an incredible piece of direct evidence. And so much about Jack the Ripper is circumstantial and people making guesses or having theories or having, you know, these implausible arguments which never pan out.
And aren't some of your biggest fans, your biggest fan base over in the Ripperologists, the Ripper people?
We sell a lot of books in London. We sell my Bloodstains in Ireland, in London. We sell quite a few in Germany. We sell a lot in South Africa, where there's a large English component to the population who are fascinated with Jack the Ripper. And they've long believed it was an American doctor. But now that the handwriting is starting to get closer and closer to identifying a particular American doctor, they're getting excited about it.
Your Bloodstains book is great. And, you know, that some people believe that it's just one of those things that's going to open up this whole new world of can you believe that this would be the case? But you're connecting based on a lot of evidence that you found. Tell people what have you, the research that you're done, you're not just some guy that is saying this because you're related. No, you've done all your research. And what is maybe some of the most important research that you are just like, this is huge evidence?
Well, Joe, thanks for that, because I'm quite proud that I'm not just another author that writes a book with the theory and then goes out on tour and says, that's what I think. You know, I've had, and you know what, to their credit, they were awesome about it. I've had history, I've had the University of Pennsylvania, I've had law enforcement all step up behind and put a lot of money into us exhuming the Holmes grave to determine if it was actually him or not.
And was it him?
Well, that's an interesting point that if you follow my Facebook page, I try to put up every new piece of evidence that emerges. When we exhumed that grave, under the directions of Judge Kenny of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania,
right,
who was very particular in deciding and ordering us that he was going to let us dig it up. He was going to let us see if it was Holmes or not, if we followed the rules and put everything back the way we found it. I mean, very particular. He threatened us with jail if we didn't do it right. And then he put the University of Pennsylvania Anthropology Department in charge. They were the ones. History was just filming, and he allowed that. But you couldn't believe the scene there. We had drones from CBS flying over. We had an NBC helicopter. We had Cameron behind him, behind trees, as we dug this up. And the Catholic Church looking down into the grave, too. So when...
What was that moment like? Because there was a moment where the dirt is all off and there's nothing but the grave. And there's still that question of whether or not he was in there for real or really was him. and then they open the grave. Well, they didn't open it in the gravesite, but then you're there as they open it.
Okay. When we opened it up, the first thing we found, Joe, and I was telling Alan this last night at dinner, was an empty fake coffin. Imagine everyone there seeing this. That's the first thing we see 8 feet down. And 8 feet's the normal level at Holy Cross Cemetery. Well, I was like, wow, empty coffin.
Unbelievable.
What's going on here? We're changing history here. And I'm ready to walk away and start writing again. My co-host, and I know everyone that watched American Ripper fell in love with her just like I did.
Yes.
Amaryllis.
She was awesome.
I used to call her Scully, and history would call and say, do not call her that. We'll get sued if you call her Scully.
Call her.
But that's the, she was authentic CIA operative, beautiful, intelligent. There's a scene I got to tell your, I got to tell your listeners about. We're digging it up, and the smell is awful. More, undescribable, okay? Think of anything you thought in your life was the worst smell you ever experienced.
Yeah.
Multiply it by 10.
Okay.
Okay? That's what it was like. And the director, who was a brilliant guy, his, some of his recreations, I think, are still some of the best television ever. He says, Mudge, jump down in the grave with the scientists and start digging with them. I said, no, I'm not going down. Because after we found that fake coffin, my co-host said, whoa, 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 we're not quitting on this. We're not quitting on this. We're going to go 2 or 3 feet to the side, and we're going to go 2 feet down. I don't know why she had this intuitive sense being an investigator.
She's a CIA.
She's a spook. Yeah. And so we dug down 2 feet deep. They sent the engineers back in there with their radar stuff, and all of a sudden we find this huge mass of concrete 10 feet down.
Yeah.
So the scientists, we were trying to see if we could lift it out. We didn't have cranes to do it, so we had to break it open right there. And as the concrete opened, the skull emerges. And I got to tell you, to be honest, I'm still 50-50 that it's him, all right?
Sure.
I'm still 50-50 that it's him. I haven't seen the evidence yet. And I know there's a part of me, there's a part of me that's thinking, you wrote a book, you got a TV show going on, you've got a bias and a preconceived notion. Let's let the evidence talk for itself. Stay back. So I'm standing back, and the skull's coming up, and he's got a hat on. He's got his coat. No pants, which the scientists explained to me later why that was, and that was because of the violence of the hanging and body waste. Mm. And then his boots. And they had removed the pants. Mm-hmm. If it was him, okay? Mm-hmm. So the skull is, and I'm staring down, and I told Alan this last night. The Catholic Church, the boss of the Catholic Church comes over and whispers in my ear as we're both looking down at the skull, okay? And I'll never forget this. He says, my son, are you sure it is, you know, what you release here today? I was like, this is right out of X-Files.
Yeah,
you know, this is Steven Spielberg should be here capturing this to make his next movie. And I'm thinking, whoa, so I'm
And then he disappeared, didn't he? He just left.
And they just left. He was never on film. Nothing.
Yeah.
History was too, they didn't appreciate the moment. So, okay, the scientists take over. And they take it back to the lab in UPenn. And the UPenn, if anyone wants to spend a day in the most incredible museum in existence, you go to the UPenn Anthropological Museum. They got stuff there from the pyramids. They got stuff there from the Incas, the Mayans. Stuff you're like, whoa, I thought we weren't allowed to do that. Can't take that stuff from places anymore. Yeah. They got it. They got it there. I was hoping they'd keep the skull.
Oh, yeah.
To keep it in the museum. Well, I mean,
the judge told you got to put it back how it was.
Yeah, he told him to put it back.
Wow.
They kept a couple.
Was there a mustache on the...
There was a mustache. So they take it back. They take it back to the lab, right? And they're... We're there, and we've got the finest DNA lab in the world, King's College in London, okay? Mm-hmm. They do the ancient forensic DNA testing for all Scotland Yard, FBI, the CIA. They do it. And they're on the phone. We got conference call going. The scientists are there. They roll the skull over, and the King's College pros are telling the two scientists exactly where they want the sample taken from the back of the skull. They actually, with a diamond drill bit, drill into this pocket at the back of your skull, and it's this porous material that gives pure DNA. Because I was sitting there thinking, like everybody else did, take a tooth, yeah, you know, go do that. Yeah. And they said, no, this is better. So the two scientists got them their DNA samples. They flew them off to King's College for them to compare with my father's and mine. Mm-hmm. They started doing tests on the body type. They started measuring the skeleton. And they started looking at signs on the cervical spine for trauma from the hanging, mm-hmm. all those things. And then they started comparing the dental records, the so-called dental records. Well, when the show came out, and history was totally honest about it, the UPenn had decided, they decided long before anyway, that this was Holmes, that this was some goofy theory by another crazy writer
That's not fair to history.
That wanted to sell a million books to make a movie and have a Lamborghini in Las Vegas. Okay, that was their train of thought. But they thought it was Holmes. There was no conspiracy to not tell the truth.
Sure.
Well, all summer long, lo and behold, they couldn't get the DNA to match. And they kept moving it back. Well, and history needed to run that final episode of the show. Okay.
Everybody's waiting.
And they want to go to the judge to get another DNA sample because they had to put the body back. Mm. And he's like, no, we're not opening it up again. You had your shot. Okay. So now the DNA doesn't match. All right. We've proven that. The body type's wrong. When Amaryllis and I first walked into that lab, I'll never forget, because she and I were like buddies at the end, yeah. You know, like punching the arm buddies. And we walk in and I went, what is that? That looks like a monkey. That's not a man. That's not a man who women thought was attractive, who had 5 wives and 100 mistresses. The arms were down below the legs. Mm-hmm. And the scientist at UPenn admitted to me, oh, yeah, he's very strange body type. He was short and stout. Anyone that's read anything about Holmes, the reporters that watched the trial, that watched him go up the scaffolding to be hung, knows that's not his body type. It wasn't that. It was long and thin. Mm-hmm. All right? Then they start measuring the skeleton. They have it out on the table. And then these are two PhD doctors, okay? They've got theses all over the world. They're brilliant. They're measuring the skeleton. Well, it comes out short. Shorter than it has to be. And I asked the scientist, Dr. Munge, the Dr. Talbot, who examined Holmes, dead man walking, before they hung him, measured him at 5'7.5". You guys have him 5'2" or less. What's happening? We think he wore lifts in his boots. And I said, where are you getting that? Did we find lifts when we dug up the grave? Did any reporters mention lifts? Did the doctor who physically examined him in prison mention lifts?
No. Meticulously examined him.
That's right. So all of a sudden now, Joe, all of a sudden, this 50-50 that I had about this being Holmes or not, now this is what I used to do for a living. I would take a trial that no one else wanted, open it up, spend months investigating each piece of evidence, and I'd win it, yeah. All right? Now, this was right down my alley. So I've got DNA that doesn't match, a body type that's wrong, skeleton doesn't match, and then I take the other scientist aside, Dr. Samantha Cox, brilliant lady. She's tough. She was the one down digging.
Yeah, yeah.
So tough as rocks. And I said, Samantha, he had a jerk so violent, the doctors there that examined the body after the drop said that the axis and atlas vertebrae were separated in the back of the neck, i.e. it was broken, okay? Mm-hmm. They weren't allowed to autopsy him. Holmes said no autopsy, which fits right in with the Holmes puzzle.
Yeah.
All right? So the doctors were examining the neck as best they could. But then, to get the rope from the flesh of his neck, Joe, they had to take knives and cut it loose. It was embedded in the neck. The fall was so violent. Mm. So I went to Dr. Cox and I said, Sam, did you find anything in the cervical spine that indicates death from hanging? No, there was no indication of trauma whatsoever. So now we got no DNA, no body type, no skeleton, no trauma to the neck. I said, well, what are you guys on? Where are you basing your proof that this is Holmes? The dental records match. the dental records. So I figured, well, if they got dental records, if they've, and you know what, a dental record is a precise phrase by a dentist which says, that's your file. Yeah. That's what work he's done on you. That's your x-rays. That's, oh, obviously they didn't have x-rays back then. But that's your work. That's the file. I said, well, show me that. I haven't seen that. Well, we don't really have that. We just have the doctor that examined him in prison that day. He took dental casts of Holmes. And I said, you mean the guy that you're saying didn't measure his height accurately? You're going to take his record of the teeth. I said, is there anything in there that says Holmes allowed him to examine his teeth and take a dental cast of him while he was in prison? The one that wasn't allowing an autopsy. Well, no, that's not there. And I said, did you guys ever stop and study how Holmes defrauded life insurance companies? His MO? Did you ever stop and look at the thing he used to falsely identify substituted cadavers over and over again? And I can use Alan to help me on this.
Yeah. Dental records.
Dental record. Teeth. That was the con. That was the scheme. That was the fraud. So now my team, and I've got a crack team of researchers, we're working on who Dr. Talbot was, the man that examined him in the prison cell. There's no record from the state that he was ever requested to be there. The prison doesn't have any record of him being there. We think Holmes requested him from Chicago, having worked with him before. Mm-hmm. We can't prove that yet, but we're trying as hard as we can. So
the next piece is Dr. Talbot.
If we can prove that Holmes knew Talbot in Chicago and that Holmes requested him to do the physical examination before he quote-unquote was executed, we think we're 99.9% of the way toward being able to tell the world, whoa, this wasn't him. This was the greatest fraud in the history of the American criminal criminal system. Criminal, okay? This was the one.
We spent the last evening, we closed Giacomo's in Irvington, talking about the theory of who would have helped him. And we had a long, deep discussion on the Freemasons. And trying to figure out whether Holmes was a member of the Freemasons. And
as we talked about last episode.
Yeah, yeah. So it's there are all sorts of possibilities, and having a high degree Freemason at the table in the discussion, it definitely is possible.
I got my guy right now looking to see if the prison superintendent was a Mason. Well, what happened recently was NBC News retracted their headline about the DNA conclusively proving it was Holmes in the grave. They pulled back. Mm-hmm. We're giving University of Pennsylvania the opportunity to pull back now. We're going to give the Catholic Church the chance to pull back, and then we're going to give history a chance to redo that final episode. Don't know if that's going to happen or not. We'll see. But I think it's enough of a story if the evidence establishes you can't say it was him. It's a little bit like saying, can you prove who God is, or can you prove who he isn't? No, we can't. Unless, if we can go back to the judge and say, Your Honor, these five pieces of direct evidence don't work. We need to take another look. We need to make sure that DNA wasn't a match. Because, and that's the show I was telling you about I'm going on at the end of the month. We're talking about the direct paternal line from me, my father, my grandfather, his father, Holmes, okay? Those are called Y chromosomes. There's no female break. It can't go off. It's an exact match. My father's and mine match exact, okay? Mm-hmm. It's exact. If it's not, if we sample another piece, if it comes out not to match again, it's not Holmes. It's not Holmes. There was a substitution made. Now, how it was done, Joe, I get asked this all the time. I don't know.
To try to throw your hands up. I don't know. I can't.
Well, what you have to always keep in mind with Jeff is he's an author, but he's a lawyer. So he looks at things in a very meticulous, thought-out way. These are not necessarily theories. These are strategies that he would take to court if that were the case.
Which is a great perspective to bring, because it gives it some legitimacy of, let's try to actually prove this in a system that we all know works, also doesn't sometimes, but also works. And that's great. That's awesome.
Well, it's fact and evidence-based.
Well, I routinely get chipped away, Alan and Joe, by guys, teams that come on and say, well, how did he fake this execution then? And I tell them, listen, this is the man that the Chicago Tribune called the greatest swindler to ever strike this town. All right? I don't know how he pulled it off. I don't know. There were people there helping him. We know that. It wasn't just him. He had wads of cash. He had the Hearst Corporation helping him. He was writing memoirs. There were, when we go back and look at how he lived in his prison cell, remember the pictures you see of him sitting in his suit, writing his...
velvet hat.
Who else got to do that at a prison? I don't know how he did this.
Al Capone.
You know, we saw
briefly,
that...
Very brief.
He lived that way in a suite, though.
I saw that suite, and you're right.
So
that's a good point. That's a good point.
But that just proves our point. He's talking about a swindler.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
One swindler and then another. There's two.
It can be done, and it has been done.
I'll guarantee you all, and this, I don't know how your listeners will take this, but if the man walked in right now, all right, and sat down with you, me, Alan, and Cindy.
In a hotel? Christy,
yeah.
Sorry.
If he sat down, all right, I would imagine he could talk us out of believing he killed Howard Peitzel. Mm. That's what he was. Mm.
Well, even his confessions, when he, for lack of a better term, when he's dead to rights, he still tried to come off of them.
Oh, yeah.
You know, he's classic Ted Bundy before there was a Ted Bundy. He was making up things to go along to prolong his life, and he would come up with things. Well, I'll tell you more.
Ted Bundy escaped twice. I'm just saying.
Yeah.
Like two times. Yeah. And all he did was not eat for one, and he was not that good.
Yeah.
He wasn't as good as Holmes.
Yeah.
So... it's just a theme that we keep bringing up because that's what they do. They're liars. Liars lie, swindlers swindle, and people who are killers kill. So why would he change colors all of a sudden on the last moments of his life when he knows he's coming to an end?
Well, and you have to keep in mind that, yes, he was America's first serial killer, but he was also brilliant. Mm-hmm. Had he not gone in the direction that he went, he'd have been a millionaire. He had patents in his name. He had and technological patents that could be in a direct line to the computers today. He really was on the ball, but for whatever reason, he went a different way.
Well, and that's something that'll always fascinate me. Why the man? He could have been a Louis Pasteur had he wanted to be. Instead, he went evil. And
I don't even think he understood why.
You know, when I was sitting there last night when we were the table, it was a fascinating group discussion. And
yeah, you should have been there.
Yeah, I was dancing my night away at a wedding. So,
and I was thinking, you know, the man. We don't have any allegations that he abused the boy. There was no allegations of sexual misconduct.
Mm-hmm.
He was a pure capitalist who decided to go that way with evil. And it's a strange concept. I don't know if he's got to be unique, and that's why I'd like the world to start studying him from that side a little more than this Hollywood fascination that I know is coming around the corner.
Well, we know specifically movies are coming, so that'll be interesting, and I'm sure it'll be at least a little bit interesting to see how they portray it on camera, especially.
Yeah,
you know.
And you asked Jeff for updates. I'll give an update that he didn't give you. Amaryllis from the show. What happened to Amaryllis after the show, Jeff?
And this was public. It's not. I'm not revealing anything I shouldn't do. But she married Robert Kennedy III.
Oh, okay.
So she is now American royalty.
She's a Kennedy.
Wow.
Yeah.
And speaking of royalty, there is a royal in the. Right now in across the seas in London, who is actually a descendant of H.H. Holmes, but in your eighth cousin.
It's
reveal who that is.
It's, you know, I'm not an expert on that. We should have Jim here with us today from last night. But, you know, many times removed, she's related to the Mudgetts. So
that's unbelievable, though.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and then on top of it, the Ripperologists or people who believe in, you know, that H.H. Holmes was the Jack the Ripper. Now look at her sitting in the palace with Prince Harry and say, wow, she could be related to the Jack the Ripper. So
yeah.
That's unbelievable. When it comes to what we can learn about it, let's like learn from it. This horrible situation he was, and like you said, you wish the world would pay more attention to that, and I do too. I think that's the most important thing. What do you think is needs to be said more about what we can learn from these terrible crimes? Because he did it as a capitalist, but it was there at any point we could have caught him, could have stopped him? Or was there? What do you think people need to know to stop that from ever happening again?
You know, that's a great question, and the image that comes up in my head when you ask something like that now is, first, I've got to have the world accept it wasn't him who we dug up from that grave. When we all accept that,
yep.
Then maybe we can put the work into, wait a minute, how did he do this? Who was involved in helping him do this? He couldn't have done it by himself. And where was he enabled with this ability to these tentacles that would outstretch beyond this one man to run these cons, these schemes, these conspiracies, which I think when the world finally digests what really happened in Chicago, okay, and Philadelphia, the trial, that's another thing, Joe, one day we've got to do a show on. The trial, as an ex-trial lawyer, the Holmes murder trial and the interaction between him and the judge and him and the prosecuting attorney, him firing his lawyers and conducting his own defense, him cross-examining his own wife.
Who was from Franklin, Indiana, by the way.
Who was here when the murder of Howard occurred. All those things never happen in American law. They don't. When it went to appeal, the appeals court sat there scratching their head. They wanted to throw it out. But they knew he was an evil bastard. So they just said, let it roll. But yeah, their decision is one of the most fascinating ones I've ever read in 20 years practicing law. So when we get to that point, when the world accepts it's not him, when the world accepts there was a conspiracy to engineer the greatest escape, you know, the one that Hollywood calls the great escape, this was it. When we learn to accept that, then we can start digging into what the man really was, I think.
How do you deal with who he was? You've mentioned this on a couple other podcasts, but I wanted to ask you face-to-face, is it difficult to know that your great-great-grandfather was this person?
Let Alan answer that. I asked the whole group end of dinner last night. I asked the group that question at dinner last night.
Well, these things happen quite by accident, and his discovery happened quite by accident. He's told that story before. He didn't choose this. You know, it's the old story that you can pick your friends, you can't pick your parents, you can't pick your ancestors.
Yeah, I'd rather it had been Abraham Lincoln.
Yeah. Wouldn't we all?
Yeah.
Wouldn't we all? So it's the hand that he was dealt, and from my standpoint, he's doing the best thing he can. With it in that he is trying to discover truth and he is trying to tell a story through the glasses of history. And you know me well enough by now that everything I do is history-based. There's an answer and you can always find it in history. With Holmes, what's always fascinated with me, you know, do you ever stop, Jeff, and think, was it really that he got locked in the closet with the skeleton when he was a little kid that changed him? Is that what warped his mind, or is that just something that was fabricated to try to explain the unexplainable in this man's head? I mean, in his life, what do you believe that was an impetus, or do you believe, as he said, he was born with the devil in him?
You know, I don't have any psychological training. I'm not a psychiatrist, psychologist, any of those things. But I have these theories about the Van Goghs, the creative geniuses in our world.
The outliers.
Holmes was an outlier. He just did his painting with blood. So all those people were tortured. They all knew that they were brilliant. They all loved their work, but they all wanted to die or kill. Or something like that. They couldn't just be happy. I don't think Holmes, from the day he was conscious, you know, walking out in Gilmington to see the flowers and the deer and the, I don't think he was ever a happy man. I think he liked women and he liked money. And if a woman got in the way of his pursuit of money, she died. That was his equation, and it's fairly simple, and it happened over and over and over again. And it's like Alan and I joke. We have these historians that want to debate how many people he actually murdered. I have no idea. The man was perhaps the world's, how do you say this? You don't want to say greatest. He was the best.
Prolific.
And best at murder and eliminating evidence that could tie him to the act. The best. He had a factory in Chicago for it, which rivaled the pork slaughterhouses. Okay, it wasn't as big as those, but that was the design he used down in his basement. And, you know, when people want to debate whether he killed 9 or 12 or 16 or 27 or 211, I don't know. All I know is when you look at what was going on in Irvington, and just the 2 or 3 weeks on the outstretch of previous and after, he had 7 or 8 lives in his hand right here. Yeah. Right here.
So when you go downtown Irvington and you drive through, think about that. And that this one spot has so much connection to history. That's why I do an infamous Indy. Because Indiana is unbelievably connected. And this is just proves another. And I'm just very happy that you joined me today. I had a lot of fun. I think, Al, is there anything else that you think I missed that maybe Jeff could go into before we leave?
Well, I on tours and in articles, in books, I try to impress upon people to don't miss the history that's right in front of you. Everybody knows that I study Lincoln, and I'm always amazed that Lincoln's connection to Indiana, besides the years that he spent here, was his private secretary, John Hay. John Hay was from Salem, Indiana. And if you read what John Hay said, he said, "I was at Gettysburg, but I was too busy running around the taverns drinking beer trying to get votes for the president that I missed the speech." He missed the Gettysburg Address. So it's very easy for people to be confronted with history, but they want to talk about something unrelated that's not as important as what's in front of them. So whatever you do, make sure that you don't miss the history that's in front of you. You can go back and speculate and theorize later, but don't miss the history that's right in front of you.
I love it. I wish you the best of luck. I hope to see you again. Maybe we'll get you on again, another trip to Giacomo's maybe in order. I also, if you guys want to find Jeff's book, you can go online. It's really easy to go to, but you also have a couple websites.
Yeah, bloodstainsthebook.com, and I'm glad you brought that up because I'm getting a lot of comments lately about my book, and I want to explain to your listeners. Bloodstains is a novel based on a true story. There may be 20, 25 books out there about H.H. Holmes, which, and I'm not being negative about this, but in my opinion are reiterations of the Frank Geyer book, all right? My book is about my grandfather. All of a sudden one night, revealing this horrible family secret and the idiosyncrasies that I had known my entire life, the strange habits, those things that I'd fought off, all of a sudden had a name. All right? I'm not saying I ever thought about murdering anyone. I never did. But I knew I was different. And that difference, I believe in chromosomes. I believe in genetics. I do. All right? That difference had a name. And so Bloodstains is about me writing how that knowledge changed my life with some imagination thrown in between the chapters.
Go ahead, Al.
But the only thing I would say is we did go to Giacomo's. And you know what kind of pizza he had? The slaughterhouse.
Okay, you got me blushing. Thanks, Al.
And you guys, it seems like you two are pretty close, too, through all this. Is that true? Can I say that you and Al are good friends at this point?
Yep. For about 12 years now, so.
Yep.
Before he was famous and before anybody knew who I am, and I'm not sure anybody knows who I am
today. Nobody else in the world that could have got me to dress up in a costume to walk in a parade, okay? I dressed up as Holmes in the parade. I still can't believe I did that, but I had a great time. That was a lot of fun.
You guys, it's amazing. That's a great memory, and I'm glad you shared that. Just to be clear, I want to make one thing clear. I didn't get to ask you. It was the diary. Was there ever a diary in your family?
No, my grandfather left me a lot of correspondence that Holmes had written. He left me some artifacts in the tackle boxes that he left me when he died.
Great. I just wanted to clear that up. There's been thoughts that you had the diary or somebody had a diary. So I'm glad you're clearing up.
I have a diary from his wife, Clara, my great-great-grandmother. But there's nothing in there regarding murders or homicides. And she had no knowledge of any of the evil that Holmes did.
I was thinking about it. My great-great-grandfather would have been an Italian in Naples at the time. And just your great-great-grandfather is H.H. Holmes. And then do you know where your great-great-grandparents would have been from, Al?
Oh, yeah. They were fighting in the Civil War on the Western Theater.
So talk about, and now where are we right now in this hotel room talking about this history? It's just profound. Yeah. It gives me chills. We all came from different places, and here we are. So,
but this is the history that's right in front of you, Joe.
Yeah, yeah. Awesome. Thank you very much. As I always say at the end of this podcast, I say stay safe. I'd like you to say it, Jeff.
Thank you very much. Stay safe, everybody.
As always, everybody, I really appreciate your time and energy to listen to my podcast. There's so many out there, and you chose to listen to mine. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Go to infamousindie.com, Infamous Indie Pod on Instagram, and the Infamous Indie Podcast with Joe Melillo on Facebook. You guys comment, like, share, rate, and review. It helps me out tremendously. I do want to tell you all that I got to more than 10,000 total listens. Thank you. Truly honored. And I can't wait to bring you the next couple of episodes. You're going to love them. We're going to just keep working to give you the best thing I can bring you. And it's those interviews one-on-one. Thank you, everybody. Stay safe.